If you think about, okay, Usher is really working over the covenant of works and linking it to a lot of doctrines. It's shaping how he thinks about a lot of things. He's doing good systematic works. They didn't have the category systematic theology by that title, but that's what he's doing. He's linking it to other doctrines. And you do see how it really is, in a sense, a paradigmatic doctrine.
Welcome to the Guilt, Grace, Gratitude podcast featuring Peter Bell and Nick Fulweiler. This is a show about Christian doctrine for everyone from the historic Reformed tradition, delivered by two friends in an unscripted dialogue. Join us as we discuss how the finished work of Jesus Christ changes everything.
Are you in the Orange County or Santa Ana area? We are exploring a church plant, Santa Ana Reformed, with the oversight and accountability of Oceanside URC and Reverend Danny Hyde. If you are interested or you know someone who might be interested in the area, please check out our show notes for a link to sign up for updates, our Twitter or Instagram at GuiltGracePod or Santa Ana URC for the same sign-up link, or simply email us at santaanareformed@gmail.com. We begin meetings on October 28th at 6:30 p.m. at 4th Street Market in downtown Santa Ana. Now on with the episode.
Hello, everyone. Yet once again, it's another day of fresh grace and mercy. This is the Guilt, Grace, Gratitude podcast, where we bridge the gap to Reformed Christian theology for your listening pleasure. And we are on a book club episode today with Dr. Harrison Perkins. So excited to have him on. He's going to be talking about his brand new book. It's published by Oxford University Press, The Catholicity and the Covenant of Works, James Usher and the Reformed Tradition. We're going to jump right in. And just as a reminder, on our show notes, there's some links. You can go to Oxford and find a link to that book and get one for yourself. There's also a link to the Society of Reformed Podcasters, other like-minded podcasts out there, which we are a member of. There's also a couple of links to find a Reformed church near you and a brand new link of a Reformed church coming up in summer 2022. So in a year from now, which is Santa Ana Reformed, which Lord willing, Peter will be a pastor of here in Orange County, California. So we're excited for that brand new news. And without further ado, we will jump in and further introduce Dr. Perkins today.
Yeah, we got Dr. Harrison Perkins, originally from the United States. He has his PhD from Queen's University in historical theology and Master of Divinity from Westminster Seminary, California, which is the place that I go to right now. He's ordained in the Presbyterian Church of America, interned a couple of churches, formerly served as an assistant minister in Ireland in St. Field as well. Married to Sarah, originally from San Francisco, and he is currently pastor or associate pastor of London City Presbyterian Church. We are super stoked and excited to have you on, Dr. Perkins. Thanks for coming on.
Great to be here, guys. Well, I'm really excited to get to do this with you. So thanks for having me.
Heck yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. So here in the States, in California, it's early morning. And for you, it's probably right around tea time, not golfing, but actual England. You're in the UK. So is it right around dinner time for tea, or what's going on over there?
It's about 20 to 3 here. So I do in fact have a cup of tea. One of the interesting things that I had to learn, I'm a coffee guy, but for whatever reason, it does catch on if you spend enough time here. One of the things I did have to learn when I came was tea time actually means dinner time. Huh. And kind of the first time somebody said, well, have somebody around for tea. And they came and we were kind of sitting there and they were cooking. And I kept thinking, like, when are we going to drink tea?
Oh, interesting.
And then we just ate. And I was like, well, I guess it changed to dinner, which was fine. Huh. It was just, yeah. And then it, like 2 weeks later, I realized, okay, what they mean by tea is dinner. So
interesting.
Yeah.
Well, if you would tell me when tea time is, I'd bring my golf clubs and then I'd be really confused. Right, yeah.
Nice. There's no golf course around here. That's weird.
So yeah, this book was great. I read the introduction and the conclusion, and it's good to introduce to our audience, if they haven't heard before, James Usher. I mean, he was so important for our Reformed tradition. So maybe to jump into this episode, could you just open it up and introduce the audience? Who is James Usher and why he's important to the Reformed tradition and why you chose to focus on him on the topic of the covenant of works?
Yeah, so good questions. I guess just in terms of basic biographical stuff. So he was born in the late 16th century, so 1581. He was born in Dublin to a fairly prominent family, was one of the first students at Trinity College Dublin, which is still there now. It was founded really to train Protestant ministers as kind of its primary focus. He ended up being professor there, but left the university and ended up as the Archbishop of Armagh, which is the highest role in the Church of Ireland, the state Church of Ireland. So he was like the head honcho, really, in the Irish Church. He was a Reformed guy. So it was still an Anglican denomination, to put an anachronistic label on it. But so a Reformed guy theologically, with a different polity than we in the kind of Dutch Reformed or the Presbyterian traditions have. So that's who he was. And he was important in kind of a wider context, because even in that time, Ireland was predominantly a default Catholic, Roman Catholic country. And so the Protestant church really had a lot of work to do, a lot of effort to put in, even to maintain a Protestant presence there, and specifically a Reformed one. So there's a lot of interesting things to consider about his life and work in Ireland itself. But then just to give a scope of what else he was doing, he had a lot of relations with the Church of England, and would come over often. I think probably the biggest hook for the listeners for your guys' show would be he was a non-attending member of the Westminster Assembly. So he was appointed. So he didn't go. He objected to the assembly even just as an event because he was a royalist. He didn't think Parliament had the right to defy the king. And so he refused to attend. But so you might say, okay, well, if he didn't go, did he have any kind of contribution, and was he really important? Yeah. So he wrote a document called the Irish Articles, which was really the first established confession of the Church of Ireland. And the Irish Articles were used by the Westminster Assembly as a source document for composing the Westminster Confession. So I suppose actually it'll probably interest, we're talking about this book today, but it'll probably be of interest. I have another book coming out hopefully early next year with Westminster Seminary Press. That's a collection of translations of Usher's manuscripts. So never before published documents, all handwritten stuff.
Okay.
And one of the documents I have there is his, in his handwriting, a rough draft of the Irish Articles.
That's cool.
So some people have questioned whether he wrote it or not. And, you know, where's the evidence? Well, now we have it, should be in print with a translation and some commentary early next year. So indeed, it does seem like Usher left his mark on the assembly. There's lots of stuff from the Irish Articles in the Westminster Confession. And there are some sermons given in the mid-1640s where it seems like it was clear from letters he was in contact with assembly divines to some degree. And it seems like he was kind of addressing debates that were happening at that time in his sermons, debates that were going on at the assembly. So that's kind of why I think it's significant to consider him in the Reformed tradition. Why did I choose him? Well, there was a couple of reasons for that. I think one, his name gets thrown around a lot in the secondary literature as important for the assembly's covenant theology. And I was doing a paper in seminary for Dr. Clark's History of Covenant Theology course. And so I decided to look at Usher. I owned a copy of his Body of Divinity, said, I'm going to read it. I'm going to write about this. And so just looking at the secondary sources, everybody was saying he's so important for, you know, the development of covenant theology. But it was two or three sentences, you know, here and there. And I'm thinking, okay, well, where's the juice? Like, where's the meat on that claim? You know, that's a fascinating thing to say. There wasn't a book about it. So I guess I decided to write it. So that was one reason is his name was floated a lot already, but no in-depth treatment. I think the second reason, and so that's more historical, theological in a sense. The other reason for the church, and I really do want to highlight this in a sense of what value does this book have for us as Reformed church pastors, Reformed church members. You know, I realize not every member is going to read this book, and that's fine. But what does this contribute? There's a big influx of interest in Anglicanism, especially in the PCA. I mean, where I'm ordained, and I was seeing a lot of that coming up, and so much of it is focused on the ceremonialism of Anglicanism. And you know, there's nothing wrong with a solid liturgy. You know, there's nothing wrong with having structure to your services and having, you know, a positive sense of ritual and, you know, repetition to these things to ingrain them in us. But at the same time, it seemed like a lot of guys were, you know, really into sacraments to the expense of preaching, liturgy to the expense of preaching. Let's not worry about precise doctrine. Let's just kind of get on with the ceremony. And so one of the reasons that I think Usher is so fascinating for the church is because he is an Anglican. I mean, you don't get more Anglican than being the Archbishop of Armagh. That's like when you're the top seat, you're an Anglican. Not that they wouldn't have had that term then, but you get the point I'm making. And what we see here is, no, he's really precise about his doctrine, and he preaches a lot, and he preaches about doctrine. And so, you know, if Reformed guys are going to look at the Anglican tradition for what they can appropriate from it, this is Reformed Anglicanism. Don't fiddle about with the Anglo-Catholic stuff, which is essentially 19th century myth. You know, that when the Anglo-Catholic movement, they said, well, we're just being real Anglicans. This is what, you know, we always were. No, look, here's a Reformed guy talking about the covenant of works, doing rigorous Protestant doctrine in the pulpit, teaching God's people confessionalism. That's the Anglicanism you want to look at. So I hope that that's kind of the value for the church and one of the reasons why I wanted to get this out there. So yeah, that I think covers those questions for you.
Yeah, no, that's
follow up with it.
That's maybe, good.
Maybe to focus a little bit too on an extra comment or two on how he really hanged his hat on the covenant of works as his as his focus. So why was that so important specifically?
Yeah, well, one of the things I suppose interesting as the biography of this book, in a sense, you know, it's based on my doctoral work. I started that project thinking I'll write about Usher's covenant theology holistically, you know, you know, do the covenant of works and then the covenant of grace, you know, and that would be kind of the two aspects of it. And it would probably have been kind of a fairly standard redo of what a lot of people have done about other figures, just focused on Usher. And, you know, as I kept getting into Usher's sources, he was just talking so much about the covenant of works. And, you know, the writing that I had done, you know, the intended one chapter that I had on his covenant of works was like, okay, that's almost the length of two chapters by word count. Okay, now it's more than two chapters by, you know, okay, we've got to split this and see what we can do. And essentially it's like, I've got a thesis level, a dissertation, you know, length study, just focusing on what he does with the covenant of works. So I decided to recalibrate a little, go that way. So in one sense, focusing on it came out of looking at the sources themselves. It's important to Usher. And I was looking at Usher on the covenants. I think in another sense, you know, this does show how, if you think about, okay, Usher is really working over the covenant of works and linking it to a lot of doctrines. It's shaping how he thinks about a lot of things. He's doing good systematic works. They didn't have the category systematic theology by that title, but that's what he's doing. He's linking it to other doctrines. And you do see how it really is, in a sense, a paradigmatic doctrine in the Reformed tradition. And I think that that is important. You know, today it's seen a comeback in recent years, certainly, and people are emphasizing that. Largely, I mean, Peter, and you know, due to some of the efforts of your professors, mm-hmm. John Fesco, who used to be there and was one of my professors now at RTS. So, you know, it's seen a comeback, but at the same time, there was a long time it was really out of favor. The Bardian tradition really had a lot of criticisms, and Reformed theology holistically, even conservative confessional sides, took a big gulp from the Bardian cup in a sense, mm-hmm. For a while, even if accidentally. That's not to say on purpose. It was just in the air. And you know what this shows is, well, it is, in a sense, a necessary aspect of our teaching. It's really, you know, you can't disconnect it from the fabric of how Reformed people think about the whole system of doctrine. Law and gospel, what is the image of God? Not just law and gospel, but even, you know, the uses of the law and that sort of thing. What eschatology, what's the purpose of creation? What does Christ do for us? So there's all sorts of places where it connects to various things. That's part of why it was such a big deal for Usher and why it's worth examining what Usher did with it and other figures too, for other people as they pursue other studies.
Yeah. So digging deeper into kind of your influences. So maybe a dual question. So who were Usher's influences theologically? So who did he learn from, and who's he channeling kind of in the future? And then also for you, how did you get into, so how was Usher's work kind of placed in front of you? How did you get to Usher's work? So both of those questions, both influences.
Okay. Yeah. So Usher, for Usher, one of the arguments I'm trying to make in this book is actually that Usher's doctrine of the covenant of works is essentially him tying together lots of ecumenical themes. So the title there, Catholicity and the Covenant of Works, comes from the one of the principal arguments of the books of the book is that ecumenical and the covenant of works didn't have the same ring. Alliteration there, and right, Reformed Catholicity is all the things. So I was a little bit of trying to seize the moment in an opportunistic fashion,
yep.
And run with Catholicity and the covenant of works. So there's these themes embedded in the Christian tradition. You know, what is original sin? How did it come about? Adam's representative role, you know, however that got explained, you know, is a theme in the Christian tradition. Augustine's doing stuff with it. People, you know, Irenaeus in the second century are doing stuff with first, second Adams and their representative roles. The natural law, you know, is a big theme in the Christian tradition, maybe with varying explanations and to varying degrees of emphasis, but it is there. Certainly, Christology is a big theme in the Christian tradition. Of all the ones I've said, that's sort of indisputable, I think. But you know, he's binding together some of these really important ecumenical ideas, just longstanding traditional Christian teachings, and he repackages them. And I don't think he does this exclusively. Just this is a study of Usher. So in a sense, one of the arguments here is the whole Christian tradition, ancient and the best of the medieval church, is an influence on Usher, and purposely so. He is appropriating things from Irenaeus, things from, you know, Tertullian, things from a lot of the ancients. I mean, he was a patristic scholar of his time. The Epistles of Ignatius, his work on producing an edition of the Ignatian letters is still essentially the set that we have today. So 400 years later, his work on patristic stuff is standing up. Mm-hmm. Nothing I do will stand that long, but you know, good for him. Anselm, he's drawing on some of this stuff. Thomas Aquinas, like he is pulling on stuff from Thomas. So one of the arguments is traditional Christianity is the primary influence outside of scripture on Usher. More proximately, I guess, you know, the guys that he cites that are really predominant and featured figures in this particular issue, Robert Rollick,
yep.
Who was a Scottish theologian. He was essentially the founding principal, as they call over here, of Edinburgh University, and a pastor there at a church called Greyfriars in Edinburgh, which is right around the corner from the university, or at least the Divinity School as it stands today. And then William Perkins, the father yep. of what a lot of people call Puritanism. I think we'll talk a little bit about that soon. Taught at Cambridge, was a pastor in Cambridge. These are kind of the two. And then another guy named Thomas Cartwright, who also taught in Cambridge, but ended up pastoring in the Netherlands. Those, especially the first two, I mean, there's a line in one of Usher's manuscripts where he tells students, read everything that Perkins and Rollick wrote.
Which is a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's the stuff you need to go check out for divinity students. So those are kind of the key figures. Those are ones that I focus on too. I mean, I try to use a method of not guessing. You know, I think a lot of historical scholarship has, I don't know if it's a mistake, I don't know if it's even avoidable in a sense, but a lot of guys, when you read, you know, these historical theology investigations, they say, well, this book was important, you know, and what they mean is people today think it's important. And so, you know, and it's had a lasting influence or lasting impact for people. And I tried to take a different approach, you know, besides just saying it must have been important, you know, especially it must have been important because somebody I like wrote it. Mm-hmm. And say, well, who did Usher say he read, you know, and trace this out? What books did he own? You know, there's a catalog of the books that he owned in Trinity College Dublin Library. Mm. What books did he own? Who did he read? Who did he like? And think about this in a really historical sense. We are in an age now where you go on Google Books, you go on Post-Reformation Digital Library, you know, you go on Early English Books Online, you can download all of these books for free, you know, and have the whole PDF. 400 years ago, you had to have a copy of the book. Mm-hmm. And for it to be important to an individual theologian, you have to know, well, that book ended up in his hands. Mm-hmm. You know, and if a book is published in Europe in the 1600s, okay, how do you know it ended up? How do you know a copy ended up in Ireland? It's not because you've got to get through, in a sense, you got to get from Europe, most likely through England to Ireland. You know, some of the guys would come up from Spain or something like that, but that's kind of a detour for us. So physicality of books, how did he use them? And trying to think about how, you know, who was he citing looking at that? So Rollick, Perkins, and a little bit of Cartwright. I think those are the guys that are most crucial. And then the whole Christian tradition were the significant figures for Usher. For me, yeah, in a couple of different ways, I guess we can answer that question. In terms of writing the book, in terms of thinking really hard about what it means to write well, in terms of what it means to do really precise historical scholarship that would stand up to scrutiny. I mean, I think I've got to give credit to Crawford Gribben, who was my mm-hmm. supervisor. He was really mm-hmm. great, would really push hard on things. He was demanding, but in a really encouraging way. Mm-hmm. I never felt defeated. even when he gave me lots to do. I do really want to give him a lot of credit. He helped me think a lot about good writing, about, you know, good presentation, and about good historical investigation, considering all sorts of contexts. Outside of, you know, that, which is a, you know, I mean, Scott Clark was a big influence on how I think about the history of covenant theology. You know, Scott has been really helpful to me over the years and just a constant source of encouragement. Really grateful for him. But certainly some of the things he was outlining about the development of the Reformed tradition, picking up where the ancient church left off to make use of covenant theology, left a mark on the way that I think about these things, and a mark on this book, because, I mean, that's essentially where I went was... Yeah. Usher picked up traditional ecumenical Catholic themes to filter into this. And there's all sorts of other guys, you know, I think during my doctoral work, you know, John Fesco's more pointed investigation into covenant theology started to come out. And I mean, he's just an amazing scholar, I think, covers a tremendous amount of ground and has really helped me think about the history of covenant theology, which figures to look at, certainly an inspiration for me. And he seems to write the books that he always beats me to the books that ought to be written. and so I'm hoping that eventually I beat him to the punch on something that, yeah. that needs to come out.
Yeah.
But right now everything he writes, I keep thinking that will be a great book, but I was really hoping to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The church is better off that he got to it first. No gotcha, doubt. Yeah.
He's got to have some like what supposedly Calvin had is they have different rooms that you can just start dictating to other people. He must have like RTS students being dictated his works and just being pumped out all the time.
I have no idea how he does it. And it's so much different stuff. I mean, he does commentaries. He does books on apologetics. He does early modern history. He does theology. He does practical, you know, stuff. I'm just like, oh my gosh, I'm a failure at life.
No.
Yeah, he's not.
No, I mean, you're a young guy and you definitely know your stuff talking about this. I mean, I just appreciate as a layman member of the church, you know, just you've single-handedly introduced James Usher to me, which I didn't really know much about, to be honest. And so I learned a lot from your book just on about James Usher. And speaking about like just his main doctrine of the covenant of works that he talks about, was there a different understanding or maybe even established idea of the covenant of works prior to Usher that he refined, or what did he do to kind of helped reintroduce the covenant of works to the church?
Good question. So there is a trajectory of development, you know, with all doctrines. And so what some people have argued, and I think that this has grounding, is that sort of early formulations still saw a really biological emphasis on Adam's connection to humanity. And so they're really thinking about representation in terms of requiring that biological link. So Aaron Denlinger has done a lot with this, that, you know, federal representation in the earliest reformers. I think he's got a lot of good work on that. Every now and then, I think maybe he overstated the difference between earlier and later versions of that, but that's kind of a small point. I overstate things too because I want to get something published. So I understand it if that's what was going on. So there is that shift, I think, that's happening. I don't know if Usher, you know, affected this shift from kind of a biological way of thinking to a more thoroughly legal representation, but he certainly encapsulates and sort of manifestly displays that shift that is happening in that time. And I think in a way that's very clear. I mean, you know, it's not superfluous to study Usher rather than somebody else, because I think he does encapsulate it in a special way. I don't know that he broke with everything before him and was kind of this, you know, silver bullet, you know, coming out of nowhere shift. And he was decidedly not an innovator. So if I make that claim about him, when we meet in heaven, he'll be very angry with me if you, if we're able to be angry. why does he encapsulate it in kind of a special way? And which is the answer to your second question, what did he do to represent this? And I think you really see it in the Irish articles. So he wrote this document as the Confession of the Church of Ireland, but this is the first Protestant confession explicitly to include the covenant of works. It was, it's called the covenant of law in the Irish articles, but it's, I mean, it's the same thing under a different name. Yeah. So I think that he does, he represents its entry, not just represents, causes its entry, this doctrine's entry into our confessional tradition. You know, in a sense, like it's part of the widely speaking confessional tradition in terms of confessional people believed it, but like he actually puts it in a confession, which then is carried, you know, more explicitly into the Westminster standards and that sort of thing. So developed in the Formula Consensus Helvetica. So, I mean, he really does, he encapsulates that shift in a very particular way, because he is its entry point into our actual confessions that we still hold to, in a sense.
Yeah, so he's, to kind of transition, he's not some backwater unknown theologian who like had some random idea about covenant of works that she said right on. He's actually fairly influential for the tradition that a lot of us follow, whether you're part of the Presbyterian Church or the Reformed Church, where he has a lot to say. And like you said, he codifies some things and actually writes them down in confessions, things that have influenced the Westminster Confession of Faith or other things. So he's a bigger theologian. I think most people know who he is, if you know his name.
I think that's the thing, you know, and so one of the interesting things about Usher, and I get this question all the time, you know, wasn't he the guy who dated creation at 4,000 BC? And he did do that. The evening before October 23rd, 4,004 BC. Sorry, I couldn't be more precise.
Exactly.
Now, the issue with that, you know, if you put that in historical context, I mean, yeah, he made the claim, and like there's no reason to, you know, try to excuse, not that we need to excuse it or not even explain it away. But the bigger question is, why is he so tied to that claim? Now, I think some people think, well, the claim is big, and so, you know, Usher is accidentally tied to the claim, which carried the day. I don't think that's actually the way to think about it. I think the claim was, I mean, I don't want to say it was unimportant, but it was one detail within a much larger book. I mean, it was on page one and he didn't keep coming back to it.
Yeah.
You know, so it was a detail in a much larger book. So why did this detail stand so famously? Well, because James Usher made it. So we need to invert the relationship of that. His argument for the dating of creation stood the test of time because he made it. He was the big deal, not the argument. His argument stood around because he was a big deal.
Okay.
Even in his time. And that's really not a controversial thing to claim, is that, I mean, he was a towering intellectual figure across sort of traditional, I mean, even Roman Catholics, you knew that James Usher was a real intellect to tangle with. So
okay, yeah, and that, I mean, that kind of answers one of our additional questions too. So you kind of tease this one out. So this will kind of land the plane for us if Nick has anything else to ask. So you kind of previewed it with Puritanism and James Usher, and then conformism. So some things that some people may not know to ask these questions, or like, what's the difference between these two things? Why does it even matter? Like, we know who Puritans are. What on earth is a conformist? So like, how would, I mean, maybe if Usher identified himself with a certain tradition, you know, kind of Anglicanism, if you're anachronistic, but yeah. So how can we understand Usher in his time period? Was he part of this tradition? Was he part of a different tradition? How did these two conform with each other or contradict each other?
So the easiest way kind of to describe Usher to get a baseline is, well, he was a Reformed churchman within the established Church of Ireland. So he was Reformed, he held Reformed commitments, and he worked within, you know, the church that was tied to his geographical location, you know, sort of grounded by the magistrate, in a sense. So that gives us a baseline, but then we have these sort of categories that fly, and one of the most easily, the more easily recognizable of the two is Puritan, right? And then on the other hand, though, in growing historical investigation, we have the category of conformist, which is out there in Anglican ecclesiology, certainly. You've got the dissenters, you know, who weren't happy to do what they were told and follow the customs of the established church, and the Puritans, as they're sort of traditionally understood, would be dissenters. The conformists were happy to say, you know, okay, whether the Bible, you know, tells me that I have to wear a surplice, you know, a vestment while I'm preaching or not, you know, it doesn't, but, you know, it's an indifferent matter. And my authorities have made a decision that our church wears them. So I'm just going to do it. I'm going to conform to these things. And I think the best measure of conformity is a document called canon law. So churches have canon law, you know, it becomes really tricky because Rome has canon law that's very extensive.
Yeah.
And you know, really controversial. That's not really what we're talking about. In the early 17th century, you know, canon law is really functioning kind of like a book of church order.
Okay.
You know, we have these. The PCA has a BCO. You guys, you know, in the URC, I don't know if you call it a book of church order, but you have something. You
do. Yeah. It's small, yeah. But yeah.
Yeah. Well, exactly. And canon law was not that big of a document at that point, even if it wasn't always agreed by everybody. And so my claim is, well, Usher is a Reformed conformist, and that's easily seen. He in fact, you know, wears the surplice while he preaches. He has other people wear the surplice. He's doing most of the kind of customs, even the rituals and church calendar stuff of the Church of England, as it's handed down even to the Church of Ireland. So he's a conformist in that sense. Well, where does that leave him with the Puritans? Because there's even books about the Irish Puritans, and James Usher is the foremost of them. Mm-hmm. He's often cited as a Puritan. And what people mean is he holds to Reformed theology. Now, there's a bigger question, though, of, well, what is a Puritan? Mm-hmm. And this is really debatable, because if you put, I mean, okay, so let's think about John Owen, Richard Baxter, and John Milton have all been called Puritans. Okay, well, John Owen and Richard Baxter had a debate in print about the nature of justification.
Yep.
You know, and John Milton, we know now, denied the Trinity. So, yeah. You know,
what does Puritan mean at that point? Yeah.
Right, you know, two Trinitarians, an anti-Trinitarian, but the two Trinitarians don't agree on what justification is. It's like, what is this category?
Yeah, yeah.
That's what it's come to mean. Now, I've tried to get, you know, Professor Clark there really helped scholarship by putting out this understanding of Reformed means people who subscribe to the Reformed confessions. Mm-hmm. I think that's a really good historical baseline. And in a sense, one of the arguments I make here extends that point that, well, what's a historical marker, objective historical marker for Puritan? And I've put that on canon law. People who dissent from canon law and object to it to the point where, you know, we're not going to do this. And that's pretty, I mean, the sort of rise of Puritanism really in a large in part explodes with the reintroduction of canon law to the Church of England in the early 1600s. So I think we do have some objective markers there. I've not said that this defines Puritanism. I've said it describes it, because I think it helps give us, it's not an exhaustive explanation, but it might help give us something more concrete. Well, where does Usher stand in regard to that? Okay, well, he clearly accepts, the vast majority of canon law, especially Irish canon law, which he has a hand in writing. So it helps if you get to write the document, you get to agree with
it. Yeah, yeah.
So he conforms to that. But then, okay, can we call him a Puritan? I've made the claim, well, with this understanding of Puritanism tied to a very specific things, but clearly their concern was to purify the church according to Reformation sympathies, right? Mm-hmm. That was what drove Puritanism, even in dissenting from canon law. Okay, well, Usher clearly has a drive to purify the Church of Ireland for Reformed doctrine. And I've said, okay, in England, Puritans are dissenters. In Ireland, perhaps an Irish Puritan is somebody who uses canon law to bring the institutional church further aligned with Reformation sympathy. So I think in that sense, Usher is an Irish Puritan, but not an English Puritan, okay. Which splits a lot of hairs, but perhaps makes it interesting.
Yeah, I found that part really interesting. Yeah, where you make that distinction based on what's going on in Ireland versus what's going on in England, and how he's a Puritan more in one and a conformist more in the other.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's a fantastic explanation in history of what was going on. Also, maybe just to kind of wrap up the episode and to explain, like, he is an intellectualist, that you explain how it, and that kind of discusses maybe a little bit of explaining the free will that we have that's decided based on our knowledge of our faith in Christ and in the doctrine of God too.
Yeah, so just to unpack those a little bit, is that?
Yeah, sure. Just to kind of introduce that to the audience, because I think that helped in the book to understand how our free will is kind of tied more to what it's dependent on, what God provides to us is faith in him first, and then we have some free will.
So we have these big categories in the Christian tradition of intellectualism and voluntarism. And admittedly, when I get into this, those are probably the occasional really deep dive that I know gets technical in the book. But hopefully I tried to be as accessible as I could be with really difficult things. But to give a sketch of this, so the question that you can really take to the bank on this, is there a reason for the things that we do? As I'm making a decision, if I go to the shop and I'm trying to pick between, chicken or beef, tonight. Is there a reason for my choice? Do I flip a quarter? That's sort of an arbitrary decision. I've just picked one and end up with beef. Or it's, okay, I had chicken last night, so I'm going to go with beef tonight. It's grounded in a reason. Intellectualists saw things grounded in a reason. That's kind of the baseline premise. So even when we come to talking about what God does, is it grounded in a reason for God? And now that seems in some ways like an odd question, but the voluntarists could argue, no, it's just God made a decision and decreed that creation will be this way. He could have decreed that, gravity doesn't exist or something like that, which I suppose that is true. But are things the way they are because of who God is? And when it comes to the image of God, we especially want to say yes. Okay, so when we talk about the natural law, which we believe is summarized in the Ten Commandments, the moral law, right? Are these a list of rules that God made up and gave to us? Or is there something more foundation? You know, could he have said, no, you should kill people? You know, it'd be great to murder. No, he couldn't do that. Why? Well, because God is life, right? His essence is life. God is life in itself, in himself. And so his image bearers should preserve the life of other image bearers, lawfully and as best they can. God is truth. And so God's image bearers shouldn't lie or bear false witness. So the natural law summarized in the Ten Commandments is grounded in God's character, in his nature, rather than something he just willed or just decreed without something underneath it. So I've argued that, Usher is an intellectualist in that regard. He sees God's nature as grounding things and grounding what it means to bear God's image. And then because of that, he also carries that into the way he sees creation. You know, God made the world to be a certain way. And so that's why it works as it does. And so God built this representative principle into the way that he relates to humanity. And so he can relate to us through the first Adam or the last Adam, who fulfills the covenant of work. The covenant of works has to be fulfilled for people to have everlasting life. That's built into the way that we are made. But because God also built representation into his first relationship with us, the last Adam can represent us rather than the first Adam. So that's kind of how that plays out, And the question of nature, bears on free will, just because when Adam made the decision to sin against God, it corrupted his nature, and so corrupted his the baseline, which then gives rise to his decisions. And so we can't make decisions for certainly not saving decisions. We can't make decisions that are that morally move us towards God. There's common grace, right? That's, I'm dancing around because I'm, there's common grace, and I'm trying not to say we can't make any good decision, because by common grace, in God's providence, sinners make, good decisions, support their families, love their parents and their wives and kids and that kind of thing. But you know what I mean? They can't make a morally good decision that's pleasing to God.
That's helpful to kind of, frame our understanding of covenant of works and who God is. And covenant of works isn't just something placed on us randomly. It's part of who he is, and how he relates to us, and the relationship that we broke in Adam. It's a hard concept, but I think it's necessary for people to think why does God do the things that he does, and why do we have to respond in a certain way to this covenant of works, either in the first Adam or in the last Adam. So that's a helpful distinction to make too. So kind of landing the plane before we leave. So you've already kind of previewed some stuff that you're working on. So where can people find you? What do you have that you're working on, people can look at and say, hey, I want to read more Dr. Perkins stuff in the future. So if you want to plug on some stuff that you're working on and how people can find you and keep up with your work.
Yeah, great. Thank you. Appreciate that. So, well, I'm a pastor at London City Presbyterian Church. So there's certainly our website. We're on YouTube. My sermons are there. I have some videos on short. These are like 5 to 10 minutes tops, trying to explain aspects of the covenant of works. Okay. I'm hoping to continue those on covenant of redemption and grace soon. Time is always is short. There's those if they're interested in that. So at the church website, I do some lecturing for Edinburgh Seminary in the systematics department. Thankful have the opportunity to do that and serve our denomination, the Free Church of Scotland. So we're the only free church in England. So we're part of the Edinburgh Presbytery. We have to do some stuff with them. I help teach some of the history modules for Westminster Philadelphia online.
Okay.
So Dr. Todd Rester does most of the lecturing. I help kind of facilitate these for online students and follow up with some more discussion. I guess you want to read more of my stuff, I try to post everything that's free of mine. You know, I can't put the book online for free. I don't have the right to do that. But all of my articles, and that kind of thing are on Academia. The Academia website. Yep, I have a page there, and you can download all of my articles. I've put my popular level, like lay level articles on there, but also my journal articles and stuff about Usher. Some of that is about his relationship to the assembly, some text critical work on whether or not he wrote this book called The Body of Divinity. Mm-hmm. What else am I doing? I have a book coming out early next year, hopefully sometime before March is the expectation. It's a collection of translations of Usher's manuscripts. So it'll have the Latin transcribed because the manuscripts have never been printed.
Huh.
But an English translation with some commentary, introductions, and some essays attached. So that should be out. I think it's going to be titled something like James Usher's Method of Theology or something, and other manuscripts. Something like that. I think we're trying to work on a catchier title. Like that. They're starting a series of critical editions at Westminster Press called, I think it's Historical Texts and Reformed Theology.
Okay.
And this will be the first volume.
Huh.
So take a look. Yeah, look out for that. The thing I'm trying to finish up right now is a book from so the Usher book is Historical Theology. I'm trying to do a Systematic Theology of the Covenants.
Huh.
We have several biblical theologies of the covenants, right? Yeah. I mean, even Voss, whether you like Palmer Robertson, to various degrees or not, some people do, some people don't. Klein, is doing biblical theology of the covenants. Zach Keel and Mike Brown have a great little book. It's biblical theology though. All of our books do something like one chapter on the covenant of works, one on the covenant of redemption. Abraham, Moses, David, new covenant. And it's kind of like, okay, we've done that. And that's great. And even the great stuff you're doing with the RTS book, mm-hmm. That's a great book, really in depth, really helpful biblical theology.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to do systematics and say, so like three chapters on the covenant of works. Here's all the aspects of it. Here's the reward. Here's lots of exegetical detail about the reward that Adam would receive, the legal basis of it. Three chapters on the covenant of redemption, trying to square it, really well with classical Trinitarian categories. What does it mean that Christ is the substance of the covenant of grace? Giving a renewed defense of, because I think Baptists hear us and they say the covenant of grace has the same substance. And they say, these things look really different historically. And they're right. And that's not our point. Our point is, whether it's circumcision was a type of Christ, giving believers Christ and his benefits. Animal sacrifices didn't procure forgiveness in themselves. These were things that taught about Christ and as means of grace distributed Christ and his benefits as the substance of the covenant of grace to believers. And the new covenant, sets forth the substance clearly. So trying to give a new grammar of our traditional categories, illustrate them well so that pastors have ready-made illustrations, direction for application, but also, a list of texts that, that they know, to some degree or other ground these traditional doctrines and explain them. Also puts our focus on the importance of the church as distributing the substance through whatever means of grace we have.
Yeah.
And then I guess perhaps taking a line from Usher, I suppose the sort of two distinctive sources besides exegesis, I've tried to prioritize our confessions, setting our baseline description, but then ancient church sources, citing a lot of patristics so that people have something new and different rather than, the same Reformed guys I've heard quoted a million times, which is great. That's true. But this actually goes back further than the Reformation.
Yeah.
And trying to establish that in Tertullian talks about the natural law, and he talks about a probation with this tree of knowledge of good and evil. Irenaeus is talking about covenants and what Adam is doing, you know, and there's an eschatology there. There's all sorts of the pieces of the covenant of works, of the covenant of grace. Irenaeus says old and new covenants have the same substance. Just says it.
Yeah.
You know, so to say we've made up something, it's like, well, we didn't make it up. Irenaeus may have made it up, but he did so in like 180. You know, so it's been made up for a long time. And if you want to overturn that, you got some work, like the whole Christian tradition.
Exactly. Yeah.
So that's what I'm hoping to finish that draft and send it to the publisher at the end of the month. I haven't signed a contract on it. So if you have a listener that is a publisher and they hear this and they're like, man, I really want to publish that.
Yeah. Make Crossway, listen up.
Yeah, I haven't signed a contract yet. Yeah, if Crossway wants it, they're welcome to have it. So
cool.
That's what I'm doing now and pastoring God's people here in London. So
cool. Yeah, sounds good. Yeah, we'll link to it. And it looks like we have a couple other dates with Dr. Perkins coming up to talk about your books.
I'd love it, guys. That would be great. That'd be wonderful.
Cool. Yeah. Well, thanks for coming on. Thanks for talking about this book, for James Usher introducing him, grounding the covenant of works in his work and where he comes from and where he brings it out. So yeah, thanks for coming on. It's been a pleasure, and hopefully we can talk to you soon.
Really a privilege to be here, guys. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you so much. Hey guys, we hope you enjoyed that episode of our podcast, Guilt, Grace, Gratitude. And we, as we've said before, we are bridging the gap to Reformed Christian theology for your listening pleasure. So we would like to make sure this is enjoyed by others around the world, and how to best do that is rate and review us on iTunes.
Yeah, and you, after you rate and review, or instead of rate and review, or doing everything all in once, retweeting us on Twitter, liking us on Twitter, liking us on Instagram, following us on both of those platforms, because that actually puts in front of people's physical face this podcast, these guests, and most importantly, the gospel, the doctrines that these guests are bringing in front of you guys. So please do that. It helps get in front of more people.
Amen. And hopefully you guys are part of a local church and you're tithing. And after that, after tithing, if you have any means left over, please consider donating to us to make sure our bridge is well paved and maintained and strong and sturdy, as again, we bridge the gap to Reformed Christian theology.
Exactly. Yeah. And you guys can find that link on Anchor, our official Anchor website. If you just go on our social media links, it'll link you to that website. It's also at the bottom of this podcast show notes. If you're on this podcast, this specific episode, scroll all the way to the bottom of that show notes, and you guys will find a link for this for three different options of donating. So we hope you guys can help us bridge the gap, pay for shipping, get nicer stuff, all for the focus of spreading the gospel further.
Yep. All for the kingdom of God. Thanks so much, guys.
We'll see you guys next time.